Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's go.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Bingetown TV and our coverage of Amazon Prime's The Wheel of Time. I feel like I've been saying Wheel of Time, but it seems like they're pushing the in front of it in a lot of the marketing. So that's a thing now. This is episode 3, What Might Be. And before we get into What Might Be, just classic Bingetown housekeeping. You don't need to do this right now, but if you would like to support us, you know, you like our jokes as we move through this episode and et cetera, just subscribing, whatever you're watching or listening on. And then if you want to interact with us, Twitter or X.
Yeah, I was just going to call you out.
At Bingetown TV. And then Discord, a link can be in the episode description on YouTube or whatever you're listening on right now. And then it's also can be easily found in our Twitter bio, I believe, in like a link tree type of thing. I don't know. I don't really handle that thing. Okay. So just a classic style. We're going to break these storylines into their buckets and just go through them on their own individually. We're going to, I guess, not again do any like overall thoughts. We're just going to dive right in. So the first one we'll do will be the White Tower. And obviously kind of the arguably the main dish of this episode is going to be Nynaeve's accepted trials. This is kind of one of the big cliff. I mean, one of what four cliffhangers they left us off on in episode 2. So we kind of talked before this. We kind of really want to focus on the third one versus, you know, the first two. So just really quick overview. The first one is essentially it's what was. So it's kind of Nynaeve goes to her past. We see her parents. We get the moment where she has to kind of abandon them. And then the second one is what is. So this is when she goes back to Emmett's Field. She wakes up next to Tamal Thor. A plague's broken out. She gets, you know, kind of talked down to by Matt's mom, who had to step up in her place because she abandoned them, quote unquote. And she has to then abandon Tamal Thor. And this kind of these two things piss her off kind of each time she walks out of the arches. And she's kind of like, at this point, she's wavering a little bit. There is some differences here from the books. They're different because they changed the season 1 storyline. So it's not like a huge deal. Like they were going to be different because they changed things from the storyline. In my opinion, it worked perfectly fine. I have no issues with it whatsoever. And then she kind of steals herself and goes through the third arch. Obviously, this was a little bit of a twist going on here. I would just say we can open up and just talk about literally anything we want at this point.
Let me jump in because I want to just say right away that Tarangriel, the one like that kind of gets highlighted in the beginning by either Shiryam or Leandrin, like they're crazy. They could do anything. If you're thinking One Piece, like Paramecia, like they can just do anything that they need to serve a purpose. And this is by far one of the most iconic Tarangriel. So like this was one of the more anticipated moments of the early part of season 2 for me. I was a little disappointed with the first two. And I was ready to be disappointed with the third one until the end, and it actually comes full circle, and I was pretty happy with it. But felt a little sad as a book reader how little time they spent in Archway 1 and Archway 2. Not sure how you two took it, because it probably didn't mean much anyway. It was just like an obstacle to get to the real hard challenge of Archway number 3. But I do still like it overall, and I'm really happy with how it ended. But the first two were a little weak. The third one stole the show for me. And we could talk more about the third one in detail because that's the important one. But what did you guys think initially?
100%. I got. Like, I was like taking notes. I was like, oh man, the little goodbye with Egwene. That was a little nice. Her and Lan kissing. I'm like, hell yeah, let's go. I've been waiting for this. And then you see the glimmer of the door behind, and I'm like, all right, well, these notes are stupid now because, like, that means nothing. It was awesome. I really wasn't expecting it. I thought the third one with the not remembering anything, like the initial going in, I thought that was just a really good, she did something crazy and she didn't want to know about it. I thought that was it. And I legit did think she said, screw the Aes Sedai. And I don't know if she's going to still say that or not. That's like a conversation I guess we can have towards the end. But I 100% thought this was like happy land for a second.
So there wasn't a single moment, like all the way until the reveal of the door being there, you thought like this is real, right?
Well, not when like I knew it was fake when she had a kid and Perrin was running around. Like I knew it was fake.
Well, that was already
up until the kiss with Lan, right?
Yeah, and then you see,
okay, yeah. I was roughly around the same spot where I was like, this can't possibly be how this is going. I mean, I knew what was coming.
I have no way of like proving this to you guys, but there was like once the scene transitions from her and Egwene's goodbye to her leaving, I guess I've seen so many movies and shows in my head. I was like, hypothetically, like, what if she's still in the gate and like 5 seconds later she was? So I wasn't like, it was a great surprise still at the end of the day. Like, I thought that was really well done because, you know, they really emphasize when she steps in, she has this moment of not remembering anything, which I wonder if that's going to translate into like her actually coming back now. Like, is she going to remember her not remembering what she originally did in the archway? So, but I wouldn't say I was, you know, I guess because I'm only a show watcher, I wasn't like disappointed with the introductions of the archways. Like, I thought they were pretty cool. I mean, the first one, like Kyle said, was a representation of the past, then the present, and then potentially the future was the last one. And they did what they were supposed to do in my mind. I wasn't, again, I had no expectations really of what they were supposed to be anyway. So it was cool seeing how they operate. And especially with the present one too, it's like in my head, is that actually happening in the Two Rivers? Like, is she actually seeing what's going on, you know, or is it just like a random occurrence that is, it's showing her to make her feel bad about leaving the Two Rivers, you know? So overall, solid scenes though. Well, that the twist was great.
It's funny that, yeah, she comes out of the second one and is like, we got to go. Like, we got to get the hell out of here. Yeah. There's a plague. And then they're like, I love how their answer is just like, don't burden us with your fears. Like, we don't want to know that shit. I just love that's like all they say. They don't really comfort her at all. It's just don't burden us with your fears.
Yeah. Like, I wonder if she actually had those conversations with Tam and like Matt's mom, you know?
I don't know. They don't know how they work.
They don't know. Out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they said too, which I thought was even honestly cooler. Like, just give it some more mystery to it all.
It's like Bruce Bolton re-showing back up.
Yeah,
I did not expect that, to be honest. I did not expect
that. They discuss, and Luke kind of got after with the Terran Greal of like, they mention here that they've learned things throughout history, but the cost has been high because, you know, people have died in the arches, people come out burned out. I mean, a big thing in, so the main difference here, just because I think it adds just a little more context, is the first one, like that Luke was disappointed in when it's her family. I personally thought it was fine. It was emotional. Is like, so in the end of book one, they're all at the Eye of the World. There is a Forsaken there that Nynaeve like kind of fights a little bit. So like he comes back in this arch and she uses the power to fight him. And it's like, obviously
rather than save her family,
obviously more
or whatever
badass than her abandoning her family as they're murdered above her. But they yell at her because they're like, don't fucking do that shit. Like, don't use the one power in the arches. Like, everyone who has done that has basically either died or come out and they can't use the power anymore. So it's kind of like that warning type of deal. So, obviously, they flip it in the show a little bit because it's literally the reason how she gets out is her using the power, which I can imagine some people have a problem with. I personally don't care so much, but...
Well, my question to that is, in the second arch, when she was trying to heal Tam Elthor, was she just not able to, or could she literally not even like channel, or what was that?
She couldn't channel. Not because like she was in the arches, it's because they mentioned it in both episode one and episode two, and that she just can't touch the source unless she's angry or afraid.
Mm.
So which she was like,
which checks out in the third one where she was actually angry and afraid.
Yeah, and it's kind of like she's also like in a very emotional moment with Tam right there, and like kind of all the practices, like, you know, close your eyes, imagine a flower bud, like, you know, those kind of like meditation level steps. And she's obviously not in a headspace to do that either.
Just really quickly, can you just explain the difference between Sangreal and Tangreal, whatever?
So
one more time.
So Angreal and Sa Angreal are basically two different levels of an item that like allows you to use more of the one power. It's like kind of like a conduit.
Right. Yeah,
it's kind of like a conduit or whatever. And then Terangreal have like a bunch of different uses. You know what I mean? So like we saw in season one when Moraine and Swan kind of like use that portrait thing to teleport to each other and whatever that was, if it was reality or not.
That was a Tangri.
The Oath Rod. Okay. Tear. It's T-E-R. So it's T-E-R,
Terangreal. Okay. Yeah.
There's a lot of like words that are like have apostrophe. So technically it's one word, but it's T-E-R.
Right. I figured there was, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything that does anything is a Terangreal. Otherwise, it's just an amplifier.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like either a fork. They're either forks or they're sporks, basically.
I guess.
I don't even know what to do with that now.
I don't know if I agree, but if it helps you, it helps you. And there you go.
I don't even know which one is which. Is the spork the
spork is multi use? Yeah, it's a Terangreal. Whereas forks only have one purpose.
I really liked the line that the Mistress of Novices had to Leandrin. Like, she trusted us and we got her killed. I hope your conscience never lets you make peace with that. I really hope it did affect her and she's not just faking it. I hope, like, Nynaeve, she actually does take this as a big loss.
There's just, like, some good book-related stuff here. I mean, I like how Shirium, they explain it in the beginning, and Nynaeve's like, okay, so I literally just walk through these three arches. Like, that's it. And, like, she gets, like, a little annoyed. She's like, I mean, yeah, if you want to fucking boil it down like that, you little bitch. And, like, that's exactly what happens in the book. So I thought that was good that they kept it in. The activation of the arches looks really cool. I mean, so you guys obviously know, like, when she has the kid and everything in land, that it's like, it's not real. We've already just talked about that. But, like, what did you think of seeing Matt, like, Matt all dressed up and then they die in the Trolloc attack? I just thought that was just all really well done.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely went all out. And if you didn't know it was basically the third arch by now, you're probably shitting yourself.
We already did. Like, they saw, saw her.
Like, I know you did.
No, she declined the first archway. She like saw the archway with Lan, and then she's like, not going.
Technically,
did she not see it?
It only shows itself.
That's what I thought was like a little.
Like, I thought she looked back, clearly saw that it was the archway, and was like, nah, I'm going to stay here and fuck.
I don't know if in my memory she doesn't turn back, because it's basically the combination of like the way back will come but once, classic line that like she hears, and then it pops up. But like I couldn't tell. Like, it was clearly less like tangible, that time with Lan. Like, it was kind of like shimmer versus like a literal archway that popped up two, which I thought was like, eh, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that felt like a little like, okay, we got to extend this type of deal. I don't know what the hell was going on with her like falling through the void and wearing the red dress and that.
That was, I wanted to bring that up too, if that was just, you know, foreshadowing her being a red. I said in the last episode, her and Leandrin are very similar. And Leandrin says it in this episode too. And I mean, clearly there is like a mentee mentor, somewhat of a relationship between them at this point. And so maybe she does fall, like in her footsteps and go with red eventually.
She's going healer.
I made the point at the end of last episode of like, my gut reaction is still to be like, ah, fuck, they fucked this up. And like, so like she comes out of the arches and is like, you know, if this test is about turning my back on the people I love, the people who trust me, take care of them, you know, like I won't do that. Like, keep your ring. I'm not your sister. And like, she is pissed off like that in the books. She's like, it's like, that's that my fate, to just abandon everyone I love over and over and over again. And, you know, for the tower. So at this point, I'm like, oh, shit. OK, like, this is going down. And I was like, I can't believe like she's leaving the tower, like they're really doing this. Like, I can't believe it. And then the doorway comes up. Like, you guys also obviously understood the twist. And I was like, these motherfuckers.
I was so close to being salty, but yeah. It did pay off like completely. And I'm happy that it kind of, that was towards the end of the episode. And I lived for the Emmonsfield 5, whatever ones we got in that vision, being peaceful. That was amazing to see. And then, of course, just more Trollocs looking good, as always. Like, I feel like the baseline for Trollocs is, it's up there for any fantasy series, as like these monsters. And they pretty much nail it every time they're on the screen. But then, yeah, she comes out, just chills everywhere, which is her freaking out. That last moment hit home with Egwene and Elaine kind of sleeping there. I know we'll backtrack for some of their scenes, but that was a really good moment at the end to actually end the episode.
Yeah. I mean, imagine she lived at least like 5 years minimum, it seemed like, in that archway, or at least like it had that experience of like 5 years in there if she had that little girl. And
it's
then
like Rick and Morty, right?
Playing Roy or, you know, magicians.
Yeah, seriously.
The mosaic. Yeah. So like, I can't imagine all the emotions of just realizing that you don't actually have a daughter and that the last like 5 years meant nothing. It was just a test. Like, that would be, she did a really good job acting. Like, she was freaking out.
I wonder why, there has to be a reason why Rand and Egwene weren't in that flash forward.
Well, they mention Egwene's dead. And Egwene's fighting. Yeah, exactly. So because she thinks Rand's dead, coupled
and
with
she's probably
Egwene
assuming
being at the White Tower.
At the White Tower, yeah, okay.
Because she says, she writes the letter about the Trollocs attacking Saldea at the Borderlands. Yeah. So it is a reality to her. And that kind of confirms to me that she didn't see the shimmer of the doorway the first time when she hooked up with Lan. Like, I think that was the purpose of it. Like, she was kind of just letting herself live the vision.
Embrace, and yeah, okay. Yeah.
Until that and final moment, and then she, yeah.
Lan's That's why mesmerizing.
I thought it was a little, long hair, down Lan.
Give me that. Let's do more of that.
And dressed up Matt. I thought they all looked good.
Dude, and Perrin, they were great. They looked great.
Matt gets fucked up by that Trolloc, and then Perrin gets smoked by that axe and was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I have much else to add. I mean, we talked a little bit about kind of like the differences in the books. I think overall, this worked. I will say that, yeah, it's hard for me to separate that initial feeling of me being like, I can't believe they've done this, you know, fuck up thing. But I think overall, like, the vibes are there. The idea behind it is there. Like, the emotional weight of it is there. You know what I mean? Like, honestly, the third arch was way more intense, I thought, than it was in the books. Like, the books, they get like kind of maybe a couple paragraphs. And this third arch felt way more like emotionally traumatizing. Like, I felt it way more than I did in the book. Good. So.
Well, I like how you mentioned it, though. I just want to really quickly agree with you on the fact that, like, I'm curious to see how Nynaeve will react now being back in like the real world, because, I mean, nothing changed for her in, you know, the visions that she saw. Like, I'm sure she's still willing to accept, you know, the leaving the Aes Sedai after seeing these visions. So it'll be interesting to see how she, I guess, either stays or leaves.
Yeah, and then I guess just one thing I'm pretty sure, re-emphasized. We talked about it, I think, around the Warder Campfire episode 4, season 1, that Aes Sedai means servants of all. I just like that's a little touch that they kind of re-emphasized for us here in this episode. All right, and also last thing here will be that Lyanna Sedai has a mean side eye. She just fucking looks over at Leandrin and walks out of the room. And I was like, I do not want to be on the other end of that. Okay. So I guess we can talk about all Egwene, Elaine. We'll kind of separate out them and kind of the Matt stuff, I guess. Just basically, I like how it's a hungover Egwene and Elaine's like, you know, aren't you like an innkeeper's daughter? Like, shouldn't you be able to handle your alcohol better? And just kind of, you know, the relationship starting to bud and grow already. And then obviously it kind of gets a little wrinkle in that Nynaeve is now dead. I love how I just like how she kind of says, like, I'm doing this out of respect, not out of, I forget the word she uses, but like, Nynaeve's dead, straight up to her. I thought it was harsh, but I think that it does kind of fit in the Aes Sedai mindset.
What a terrible way to find out. Like you said, she's hungover, not really expecting it. Like, didn't they say they were late to like some class or something like that? And all of a sudden you get a hit with that and she's like, ah. Don't want you to find out this way, but yeah, your friend's dead. Mm-hmm. Wild. And then kicks her. I'm sorry. I always just want to call her daughter Air.
That would suffice, but Elaine.
I like that.
Elaine.
Yeah.
What are you calling Nynaeve's cool replacement? Nynaeve's replacement.
Kicks her the hell out. She's like, I don't even know you. Oh, that was that was funny.
Yeah.
My only comment I'll add is just that I think Shiryam just like does a great job at playing her role. I know she doesn't get a lot as an actor, but like I've been craving that sort of presence in the White Tower, and it just makes so much sense. Anything to do with novices, she's involved, including the accepted test, and it's just like she would be the one kind of cleaning out the novice room and like delivering this news to Egwene. It all just makes sense, and I like her as a presence. I hope she's just consistently there anytime we're in the White Tower, because she is in the books just like a character that's always around in the White Tower.
Yeah, I think they've captured the gravitas of her well.
Right.
Okay. The next thing we'll get in Egwene's storyline is going to be So now she's, I guess, in that first stage of grief, maybe like denial, and then she's upset. Now she's taking action. So we see Leandrin is dumping Nynaeve's kind of empty, gemless, accepted ring into that kind of cauldron of fire at the top of the tower. And Egwene confronts her, and things get a little fiery. Things get a little fiery here. This was very unexpected for me.
Fiery. Mm-hmm. Nice. Because yeah. She casts that wall of fire. Without hands, that was cool. They didn't make that a point because she was training. She was like, didn't come here for easy mode. So that's cool to just see her fucking just toss it up there. And Leandrin's reaction is just so cool too. She didn't like react that much. She just kind of stopped and then just like countered it real quick, sucked it up and like walked towards her. I was like, God, it's so scary, Egwene. How did you do that? And she didn't say, well, she stepped back a lot, actually. But eventually, at the end, she took like two steps forward and got in her face. And that was tight. Yeah. You have no idea
what I'm capable of.
I wasn't crazy about that. The whole the fire was definitely sweet. But when she like steps back into land, I'm like, all right, settle down, Egwene. Like, you know, you're nothing here. But no, definitely
like
really Leandrin cool.
Could like ruin her life if she wanted to.
Yeah, that's
there.
What like
I'm, like if she could like, totally just support like report that I guess to Sheer Yem Sedai and be like, and Egwene would just be like literally scrubbing toilets with her tongue for the next like year.
Egwene has like shown herself to be like a complaining like crybaby almost. So like her just like
what?
Going up to Leandrin.
I just a hard worker, dude.
She hasn't complained until last episode for the first time ever.
Yeah, but she's like internally complaining yeah, about like she's internally okay. Salty about like
yeah. Everything. I feel like you would be struggling as well in a similar position.
Yeah, but I'm at the end of the day, I'm just saying for her to come back and be like, you have no idea what I'm capable of is like, all right, like settle down. But yeah. I think at the end of the day, Leandrin, I don't want to take away. Yeah, it was still a great scene.
Leandrin stole the scene for me. I think she is so freaking badass. That just wave, it keeps reemphasizing how strong the Aes Sedai are compared to the novices. And yeah, like just wall of fire, just by and then turns around, just doesn't lose her cool at all. She's just Leandrin for president, man. She's doing it for me completely this season. And I just her actor, I just didn't expect her to be as prevalent as she is, and I'm super happy about it because she's just fun when she's on screen.
They must just have a blast writing her dialogue because I feel like her dialogue is the best.
Mm-hmm. It's been cool seeing her open up to a little bit more, especially with Nynaeve in general, especially I don't know if it's here or later on when she's like, I respected the hell out of Nynaeve and all this stuff. So it was really cool seeing how Nynaeve kind of has opened her up a little, just like a little bit in my eyes. And Egwene comes in, you know, shouting all this stuff. And she doesn't really even know that Leandrin actually has also kind of developed a relationship with Nynaeve as well.
She said she believed in her.
Yeah, that's what it was. She believed in her. And there was like, I think to another Aes Sedai later on, she's like, I respected the fucking hell out of Nynaeve.
That was to Matt, but yes.
It's like, oh, that's who it's it was, like yeah. Disguised to Matt. Yeah. I just like the line that it's not only the most powerful women who write history, it's the ones who survive.
Yes,
that's
just I like that line.
An important thing to think about. I mean, it's pretty similar to the idea of like, you know, history is written by the victors or the winners type of deal, but I thought in the context that it worked well for what she was trying to get across to Egwene. All right. So the next thing that's for Egwene is that she just kind of obviously now she's back maybe in that denial stage. She's trying to open the arches and she tries to open that third one herself but fails. First thing I thought of was that the CGI just looks so much better in this season. I mean, I've kind of thought it throughout, but that's one of the notes I wrote down for this scene is that it just, the channeling CGI looks so much better in this season.
Like I can see like every strand of
right.
Yeah.
Each weave. It's awesome.
Yeah. And then, I mean, main part here is just that Elaine, the daughter of Aerys, she's a rider. She's just a good friend. She's willing to be there for, Egwene, but she's also not bullshitting her. You know,
she
I like that
the truth.
She tells her like it's not gonna work. Like you literally can't do it. Hundreds of people have tried. It's okay. Like we can stay here. I'll grab blankets and shit. Like, but don't throw your life away because clearly Nynaeve wouldn't have wanted that. I just really like what they're doing with Elaine's character.
Do we know how long it was in the actual White Tower? Like it was like 5 years for Nynaeve in there, but was this all in like one day or was it like a few days?
It's difficult to say, I guess. It doesn't seem like it was that long.
Okay. I would say a day or two.
I can't imagine, Egwene would go a whole day almost without like trying to talk to Nynaeve. So I would say, yeah, like they did it in the middle of the night. I'm sure it was literally the next quote unquote next day. So like,
yeah,
maybe like a total of 16 to 18 to 24 to 26 hours.
And to follow that up, do we think, or is this like completely out of the question, that Egwene trying to activate the arches had any like homing beacon for Nynaeve, or was that just coincidence? Because I mean, it was later on when Nynaeve came back, it wasn't right even after she was trying.
I don't hate that idea. I feel like that would have been a better explanation. Oh, maybe that's what like the little weak shimmer was. I might headcanon that, because I didn't like the idea of like she only gets that weak, like it doesn't even fully realize itself as an arch. Yeah. It just kind of shimmers and you can tell it's different. And then she hears like the way back will come but once. And then she kind of is like, what was that? Oh, I don't care. You know, but with the other two, like it was very like literally it felt like an actual archway is next to her in the cellar. You know, it's literally in the room across from Tam's bed. So
the first visual was Egwene zapping the arches for you.
I'll take that. Yeah. Okay. When it like glimmers when she first meets Lan behind her.
When Nynaeve comes out, like there's no signs of like Egwene and Elaine doing anything, right? It's just she just comes out. Okay. I was just thinking that maybe Elaine did eventually help Egwene, but didn't.
Unless the secret is to fall asleep in front of it.
Yeah. Ah. Paul figured out the Taran Grial, something that the Aes Sedai couldn't figure out in the past 3,000 years. None of them ever took a nap in front of the arches.
Nope.
Oh, Paul, you're a visionary. That's the last thing, honestly. I see, like we just said, Nynaeve comes out, collapses in grief.
I guess we can talk about it now. Do we think that Nynaeve is going to stay in the tower with Egwene, or do you think she is going to do what she did in her quote-unquote vision in the arches and separate and go back to the village to actually try to take care of that disease? Yes.
I'm going to put on the board that I think she stays. She made herself some very good points by like in that third archway when she's talking to Egwene, like I've realized now that you don't need protection. And even when she goes in, you know, Leandrin asks her, you got to make sure you're doing this for you and not someone else, which it has felt like Nynaeve's whole presence and time here at the White Castle, of course, has been all for Egwene. But I think after now having these experiences under her belt, I think she's now able to see the bigger picture, I guess. And I'm thinking she's going to stay as an Aes Sedai or stay at the White Castle.
Just for everyone, if this is the first time you're listening, that is a little inside joke there. Okay.
It's possible, because if people binge the first three, they might just jump into this one. So,
yeah.
All right, Paul, what do you got for what's your answer? You asked the question. He's thinking, by the way, if you're listening.
Yeah. The steam's coming out of his head right now.
That's a thinking face if I've ever seen.
Oh, okay. I got it. I think
so ridiculous.
I think that since Leandrin already destroyed the ring and she made some sense in her vision, I think she's like, you know what, fuck this, I am out of here, and I'm gonna dip and go back to the 2/4 rivers.
I really can't see it going either way. I don't know.
Okay, Dave, if she stays, what's your Aja prediction?
I'll agree with Paul. Even though we saw her in red, Lady in Red, by the way, shout out Big Mouth, but I'm going to go with Yellow. I think she is going to be a healer. If the visions were just, especially with the plague that she saw in the second archway, and I think, and how she's reacted to seeing the healers in the infirmary and things like that, I can see her going Yellow.
Okay, so you think the Lady
but she'll
the
just be like a...
was a red herring.
Yeah, I think so. And I think she'll just be like the most powerful. She'll be like a battle age at the same time, of course, because she's the strongest being to come through their doors in 1,000 years. But I think she'll want to be a healer.
Mm-hmm. All right, fairs. Yeah, I mean, it's clear that, you know, her name is well known in the tower. And if she is to stay, obviously she won't have any lack of suitors for the Aja's coming to recruit her. All right, so now we'll do Matt's storyline in the White Tower. Obviously, there's a level of intersection here with Leandrin's storyline and kind of the post Nynaeve's, I guess, quote unquote, death. Leandrin reacts to it by setting him free. Obviously, this is a little bit of a red herring for us as the audience, and that she's kind of using this as an excuse. She gives Matt a fucking reality check for the ages. I mean, again, her episode was very quotable. And then we get, you know, Matt and Min. And then we obviously get the twist in that storyline, which is a little upsetting in that Min and Leandrin are kind of working together. It's not obviously like an equals relationship, but I think we can literally just talk about anything we want in this Matt and Min storyline.
Matt was a fucking coward when he saw Egwene and walked away from her when she was crying like that. That was just, I hated that scene. Yeah.
I felt it coming.
It was just like watching him fucking stay back in season one. It was the exact same feelings I was feeling. It's just like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? Just get the fuck in there.
And Leandrin just said that. She said, you betrayed your friends and you would do it again. And she said, you know, you lost somebody today. Your friend needs a friend. And still he fucking dips.
Who do you think got more wrung out? Land by Moiraine or Matt by Leandrin?
I mean, Land by Moiraine, because it was relentless over months. But I mean, in the moment, dude, that the quotable line is nuts. I mean, I love it. I wrote it down because I loved it so much. But like, Moiraine might have seen something in you. Light, darkness, wink, wink to Dave, importance, but I see nothing. You're an insidious coward who mistakes his own moral failings for cunning and wit, which I think is a great summation of Matt's like early character.
It's so true, yeah.
And then a stupid, desperate boy who wallows in self-pity, blaming his friends for leaving him. You left them, and you do it again. And my note right after that just says, she is legit killing this role. I am just in love with this.
She did. She has been fantastic, absolutely. Yeah.
And the best part about it is because they're Aes Sedai, like her and Moiraine, when they ring people out, like they can't lie.
Yeah, it's the truth. Like it's 100% the truth.
Yeah. And she has that line to Egwene earlier too. Yeah, she's like, you know, Aes Sedai can't lie, so hear my words and know them for truth. And I was like, sheesh.
Yeah, there wasn't no like we're not equals kind of thing, Matt. Like this was like I felt like straight up me just telling you how it is.
Yeah, that's awesome. I didn't even realize they can't exaggerate and like make shit up. This is straight up the truth. That's awesome.
Yeah. Another strike against Matt is that he like makes a joke of like, oh, I bet she was real old, and it's literally his friend who she's talking about.
That's shitty. She probably did that on purpose, obviously. Yeah, but probably. Like, what a terrible way to approach it. But in my head, because he was so used to the noises that she makes coming in and out, I had like, do you think he was fake sleeping when she walked in there just to like appear weaker than he actually was? Or do you think he was actually got startled?
I feel like he's always been putting up a front to her that he's like weak, especially when we first got introduced to the new Matt. Like he does look pretty bad, but as soon as she leaves, like we see the charisma coming out. So I think it's all a front. But after being wrung out, it's not a front. Like he is just like completely depressed and like
I don't think that was fake crying. I think
that was not fake crying.
Those are real tears, I think.
But I think originally before he got wrung out, yes, like every time she appeared to him, he wanted to appear more weak than actually.
So we talked about last episode, the annoying like Nynaeve happens to be outside the door for the bad and then walks away right before the good. And then I felt the same way with him looking, just staring at Egwene, and then he decides against it. And then right when he walks away, she looks. I was like, ah, fuck off.
Like full body in the archway for, I don't know what, 25, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And as the second he goes behind the wall, what was that?
Yeah. They're taking the piss at that point. So Matt kind of returns to Min, and I like how we discussed the last episode about the level of chemistry they have. But Min kind of immediately shoots down the romantic shit. So I'm curious of how we're feeling about the potential. I mean, obviously we learn at the end that she's kind of leading him down a road. But I'm just curious of what you guys think still on that lane, because we talked about it last episode.
I think that she's doing it for his protection because he doesn't want to get any romantically involved. And then, the truth comes out saying like, you know, I've been tricking you this whole time. I've actually been working for Leandrin. I like to think that she's keeping it strictly non-physical for his sake. At the same time, I mean, Matt's pretty down in the dumps right now and not very attractive, I'm sure, to a lot of people. So
I mean, yeah,
he's a good looking guy, but he is looking tough right now.
Yeah, I think when we first saw them interacting, I was feeling the spice between the two of them, but now I feel like it's getting more platonic. Like, he already was, when he brings down the cabinet and is like talking to her, he's invites her over and he's just like, yeah, I'm not trying to, you know, make a move or anything. And from then on, it just felt very platonic. So
yeah, it does get back to good chemistry, though. I like the little thing they're throwing around of like, when Matt's like, oh, like, they kind of just basically joke about liberating supplies rather.
Yeah,
thought that was, you know, they're kind of the same mind with that stuff. They do have that level of chemistry still, which is really good. And I think Min looks like, the outfit looks sick. I thought she looks good with the haircut.
Love the haircut. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't like in love with the character design in season one, but I'm really warming up to it. And I think that she looks great in this scene.
I'm always in for a shaved head.
Looking great. Let me lead us into this next bucket. I'm just going to, I don't know if this is what you have last, but inject Randall Thor into my fucking veins anytime he's on the screen. Like, I live for this dude. And I was a little surprised at the Loghain scenes, to be honest, but everything else, like, basically they're still incredible, but just anything he does is just so interesting to me. And like, we start off hot basically at the end of last episode when he goes and meets Loghain. And we find out right away, like, Loghain knows he's an Aiel. He can see the red. Loghain knows that he saw him in Tar Valon, and he knows that he can channel. So he knows like everything right off the bat, which is, adds to the more, like, the mystique of Loghain anyway. And that is the first confirmation of the power, right? Like, of him being able to see other male channelers. Did we talk about that yet?
At least that I know of.
Yeah. That was awesome. That made that scene of him laughing in the cage so much better from season
I one. Forgot right. how much I fucking love Loghain. He is just so great. I mean, we only got to really see him like strength wise in season one, which, you know, I'm all for. I'll take any strong character any day of the week. But now we're seeing a little bit more of that like cunning and like slyness that he's got to him. And And Rand's great too. So just the combination of both of them just makes me just so horny.
He says to him, like, he basically says something similar to when he saw Nynaeve's powers. He said, I saw how strong you were and I knew you were going to shake the world, which is just epic. Just an epic line coming from a false dragon like that. And then he goes on to have this conversation with Rand. He knows what Rand wants. He says, Rand says, I want to know how to control it. And then that leads to the talk about demanding the wine for the lesson. So like, that's the whole beginning. And so I guess, Paul, did you have anything else to add about just like what we're talking about now, I guess?
I mean, absolutely wild meetup that, like, obviously we got at the end of last episode, but I didn't think Loghain was going to be coming back this soon. I dig it. I love it.
I like Loghain's dialogue of nah. That was so funny that's the way they wrote that. I have two takes mostly on this. One is that I think that the glow around Rand is weak for being the brightest that Loghain's ever seen.
Yeah, it did feel a little underdone.
Yeah, he just doesn't look. I mean, he's not like glowing like the sun, like Nynaeve.
Like Nynaeve was glowing. Yeah,
so that's what it was kind of like. Okay. And then the one weird thing here is that he is severed from the source at this point. So should he be able to see that is a question mark.
Did he say that he could currently see it? Oh, you're talking about when he was getting walked through Tar Valon.
Yeah, I mean, he's severed at that point.
Yeah.
So that's like an interesting thing. Again, though, it could be like this unreliable narrator thing. Like, that's what Loghain thinks that he's seeing, but maybe it's potentially something else. I mean, we'll see. Obviously, there's time for them to explain it. But right now, for me, that feels a little...
If it's similar to Min's power, though, right? Like, you don't necessarily... It could be like a one-off thing that's on top of his ability to channel. Because, like...
I mean, if they want to make a new... Yeah, if they want to invent a new power, for sure.
All right. Well, what I was trying to think of earlier was Luke. You were talking last episode that Loghain's mindset probably was that he believed Nynaeve was actually the Dragon Reborn because of what he said. Do you think he's mad right now and he's like actually mad and believes that he is and like he regressed back into that? Or do you think he's like actually just in denial and he truly does believe that Nynaeve is like the Dragon Reborn?
That's a good question, because we didn't have this information that he saw Rand with the power around him when I said that, because he might have seen Rand and said, okay, he's even stronger than Nynaeve, because that was after the fact. So that's a really good question. I don't know. And you got to add on top of it that he is a little bit mad. So like, you don't know like how stable of the decisions.
And by mad, you mean
are.
Crazy and not like yeah. angry, right? Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. Crazy.
I just want to make sure I the was madness. Like, they could have. Yeah. Been.
I have angry skills.
And I'm skipping ahead a little bit to another scene, but he references that he can hear LTT, Luz Theron
Telamon.
Yeah, he's saying that he can hear him, and we did have a visual representation of what he interprets as hearing them in his intro in season one, which I thought was amazingly done, by the way, when it has like the little people in his ears, and he says he's hearing all the dragons from the previous lives. So he truly believes that. I just don't know what he's thinking about the comparing his power level to Nynaeve and Rand, who he thinks, I think, are stronger than him, but he's still hearing those voices. So maybe he's convinced that he's still the dragon. I don't really know. There's a lot going on with this dude, but every time we get more like conversation from him, I'm sure we're going to be able to kind of scope in on what he actually believes.
Yeah, I mean, they're clearly painting him as an important character. So
Huge plot hole now that you're talking about. He saw Rand like with the glow after he was cut off. Like that's how
I'm feeling in the moment, but like I said, there's still potential leeway in the future. We'll see what happens with it, but for right now I'm gonna say that I don't like it.
Only thing I can think of, and being devil's advocate here, is just like, because he's already had it's like one of those things where it's this is going to be a terrible explanation. I don't know if this is even going to be close to it, but I imagine like you were just granted the ability to know everything, and then that ability was like taken away. It's not like you would immediately forget everything, you know, like there would still be some facts or information that would still be in the back of your mind from experiencing that level of power, I guess, in a sense. And that's kind of how I'm taking it. I agree. I'm still on your side. I think it's a little bit of a plot hole right now, but that's just kind of how I took it, I guess.
I think that analogy totally works in what you're trying to say, first of all. And second of all, maybe that's what they're going to say.
But it would
say,
still be kind of like stupid because he's like, gentled.
Book knowledge, it's like a hard cut.
I would agree. You know, like if you're cut off from the source, like you should be cut off. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, like that makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see. All right. So Rand kind of leaves that conversation, heads back to the Foregate. We just get a lot of good things going on in the background here. We get more information about the hunt for the Horn of Valyr being called. And then we learn that, you know, there's the Queen of Kyrian gets mentioned. We see in the background, which we saw last episode, but I didn't mention, is that like there's some construction going on in the city. So like they're nailing all of this like little outside world building that's going on, except for the Queen of Kyrian, in my opinion. In the books, it's a king. We'll see if there's any twist or something, information about that. But we basically just get the point of this scene is going to be that Rand is enlisting Celine's help in obtaining the bottle of Galdanian Red for Loghain. So I guess before pre-party, I'm just curious if there's any takes about anything that was going on.
It's just, for me, just I need subtitles. Like when Celine, like, or when Loghain is asking for the wine, he says something. I probably played that scene back like four times. Like, what is he saying? And then it was like 3 seconds later, if I just kept the scene going, I would have found out that it was a bottle of wine. But it's just the names and places of people, it's just so hard for me to get without the subtitles. Mm-hmm. Other than that, though, this just again felt like an Aretuza scene from The Witcher, just like this conglomerate of like rich and wealthy people coming together. Like, these people are from here, these people are from here. And it's just great getting that level of like world building. I know this show is going to last a while, so they have to, you know, incorporate these aspects early on while they can.
Yeah. So we get, I mean, just like to reiterate some of the things that we learn about the hunt. I mean, there's a gleam in there. He has that like patchwork quilt cloak that's like pulled straight out of the books. He mentions that the horn will summon the heroes of the ages back from the grave to battle for the light. It's been 4 centuries since the last hunt was called. So this, again, plays in our theme at Leandra, and I think mentioned this in episode 1 of this season, of like there's all these things going on in the world that haven't happened in a while, and like clearly something's brewing underneath the surface within the pattern. And then just an interesting thing that we see is that there's people getting branded with a horn on their forearm. That woman gets branded. So I'm curious. It seems like an easy continuity, cool thing for them. Like, we'll meet characters in the future that will have that brand. I think that will be fun.
I just have a quick question about the horn. So I feel like I'm remembering from season one that someone said that, like, only the dragon can use the horn, but there are kings and queens. Like, is it just public knowledge? I guess, is it not public knowledge that only the dragon can use it? Am I misremembering that? Or do people just assume anyone can use it?
So people assume anyone can use it. The soldiers at Faldara
say
we have this, and then maybe Perrin or Loyal, or probably Perrin, is like, oh, we're gonna use it or whatever, and they say like it's for the dragon. So that's their take on it. Like,
they're saying like it's for the dragon, as in like we'll just save it.
They've
for
been
him.
Safeguarding it, yeah, for okay. him over but the anyone ages, can the centuries. Use it. Okay. Yeah, but technically anyone can use it. Okay. That's why the Queen of Kyrian's like, hey, I'll offer you, I guess technically fake, we learn in the party scene, I'll give you half my fortune for it so that she can kind of have it, I guess is the point there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the party scene's great, in my opinion. Just fun. Again, Dave, on your line of thinking of subtitles needed, I literally had to watch the next episode to learn what this woman's name was, because I was like, it's clearly important and it's pissing me off that I've tried four times now to listen to it and I can't get it. But it's Anvar, Lady Anvar.
Anvar or something.
You could probably take it. It's Anvaere. Okay. That was probably too many. I just want to write to
who was that one. I'm just like writing these names down with like a brief description. Who was that one?
So that's the woman that warns Rand of the invitation. From Lady Delay. I just spelled it phonetically in my notes.
I mean, that's
who knows if that's what it was.
If you guys were to look at my like season two characters and descriptions, like it would be a complete mess.
Yeah.
I mean, Inktar is just going to stay Inktar for the rest of the recordings.
That's just classic Inktar. We just kind of get, like Dave mentioned, we get a lot of world building here. Just curious if you guys have any more takes. If not, I can keep talking about this scene, but I don't know if we want me to just keep talking straight.
Could you imagine if Rand actually just hit that? That'd be crazy. But also before that, talking about the brands, I honestly, the first thing I thought of was like everybody that is getting branded is actually getting like a seal or sigil on them, and it's going to come back and like somebody's going to activate something and they're going to all be like affected. And the only thing I can think about and compare to is in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie when Plankton puts all the bucket hats on everybody and then all of a sudden he activates it and the bucket hats go down. I'm waiting for like somebody to activate it and then like I don't know.
Similar
to
the dark mark too. Like you touch it, everybody just like
we're putting that on the board for sure.
Just feels like I don't understand, because the only reason you're getting the brand is because you're joining the hunt for the horn.
It's like a profession. So like people like take pride in it. This is like a honorary, like it's not also, celebration, I mean, like, but like it's like an event, like a global or not a global event, but a countrywide event. Like they're gonna go out and try and become a hero that can be written in the histories of having searched for the horn. So it's like a thing. Like some people want to be hunters of the horn. So it's like they're self-identifying. I
mean, like they said, it hasn't happened in 400 years. So like imagine there was a tournament that we could join that hasn't happened in 400 years. And all it took was getting a brand as like the official. And it's hard to say if it's even their official invitation. Maybe they're just like, dude, I want to fucking get this brand.
It's like tatted up.
It's basically just getting like a tattoo that like I was a hunter for the horn. Mm. You know,
I have a couple takes though. I'll just throw out there. We're just talking about the whole party too, right? Like everything about it.
Yeah, that works for me.
Because how can we not bring up his amazing costume? Like what he's wearing is epic. And that is like, he actually is supposed to get something that looks similar to that earlier in the story, like in the early of the books. And he actually constantly is getting made fun of for looking like a noble by Perrin and Matt in the early books, pre this like portion
nice,
of it.
Nice clothes, dork.
Yeah, like this is like iconic. I'm pretty sure he's wearing it on the cover of the second book too. This little jacket. So I was freaking hype as a book reader seeing it, and just seeing Rand like kind of look like the dragon. It gave me flashes of LTT from season one when we saw the flashback to 3,000 years ago. Like he looked like an official like dragon. So like this was a cool little glimpse. But what I really want to harp on is I am over the moon about Rand and Celine's on-screen chemistry. Like it's so good. Like, I think she's amazing. I didn't expect her to, I knew she was going to be awesome, but I did not think she was going to be as captivating as she is. Just like their sexual tension, their back and forth, their pool, like how they kind of clash, but at the same time, you could tell they care about each other. All of it's really doing it for me. And then of course, like for anybody that is fans of the book, the game is kind of mentioned here. It's like talked about. And this is one of the famous scenes that kind of kicks it off, is Rand getting confronted with a letter and saying like, ooh, like everybody's looking around. What are you going to do? You're going to say yes or no. And he burns it. And everybody's like, ooh, good move, good move, good move. Like, it's just like a thing. Like, it's like the Game of Thrones, but like the game, the political game that Cersei's always talking about. It's super important in the books, just like in terms of politics. And you guys know I like that portion of fantasy books.
In this city, too. She mentioned, Celine says, this is the most political city in the world. Everything's a scheme or a game. They call it Dies de Mar, which I think translates to it's the game of houses. So it's everyone's just like maneuvering all of the time. And I thought it was great. Like Luke said, they'd have him tossing it in the fire, because in the books, it's obviously they have more time to flesh things out, where he's just like getting invitations every day to where he's staying and people are coming up to him and like what he wears. And he's like, I don't know what the fuck is going on, but like everything I do, someone reads into it. And it's just like so funny how it escalates, literally to a point where he like almost like gets an audience with the king. And he's like, what the fuck is happening right now? So they did a good job, I think, of giving us that idea and just this quick kind of one-off scene, which I thought was great. And
did
also,
they mention it? Did they mention it in the last episode that he is like pretending to be like a lord of like one of the outer cities? Or is this the first time we talked about that?
This is the first time it's brought up, because Celine says like, this is fun. Like, they think we're outland lords and they're trying to see like how they can use us to their advantage and stuff. And then Lady Anvir is like, you're staying in the fucking Foregate, ain't you, little punk? So she kind of reads him immediately.
She's a good game player.
Yeah, she is. I'm assuming we'll see more of her. I feel like it was very deliberate that woman is who kind of went up and spoke with them. I like how Celine gives her the cold shoulder. She's like, back off my man. And then just another little important thing here. We talked about it last episode with Rand kind of handing the coin. They're just kind of pushing this characterization of this like duality of Rand a little bit. Luke mentioned it a little bit with him and Celine having this like somewhat like violent, aggressive undercurrent of their relationship a little bit. But here he's like legitimately upset that the Hunt for the Horn is like a ploy for the queen to kind of clear out all of the refugees from the war 20 years ago that are living in the Foregate. I mean, we've seen that it's kind of just like the slums, and Rand is clearly upset by this.
Mm-hmm. Good guy, Rand.
He's a good guy. Good guy. And then another thing for book readers is that Celine mentions he's going to miss the fireworks. Fireworks are like a really big thing in the books. Everyone like always gets amped when they know fireworks are going to happen, because like they're just like pretty much been reinvented again.
Think Lord of the Rings. Like are the hobbits are hype when Gandalf shoots off the.
Yeah.
It's the same. So that was
I'm ready for the battles in the sky. Battles in the sky. I'm keeping that in the mind. I want some.
You think it's going to be a fireworks battle?
No, I'm thinking it's going to be fire breathing dragon. Hopefully, those
I don't know. We have anything else to say about the scene where Ran returns to Loghain with the wine?
You ever leave me like that again, I will kill you. Well, that's not.
Well, so I guess that's a no, dude. I mean, that was also an answer to the question. A little Aes Sedai over there.
I thought you were going a different direction with that. But no, I just like that line with Lassine. Is that her name?
Celine.
Did you just say Lassine from Malazan?
No. I thought you were combining Lizzie and Celine.
That is insane. And that is even funnier if you were combining
That works in both of those senses. It's not that bad.
Lassine, that's so funny.
That's 100%.
The only comment I'll make on this Loghain Rand second scene when he brings the wine back is just Loghain's rant about the Aes Sedai, saying like the madness in his perspective, obviously the madness isn't a real thing, just an excuse for the Aes Sedai to justify their dominance of the world, essentially. But they know that only the dragon can defeat the Dark One. So it's just, I think, good to get his perspective on the Aes Sedai. If he's going to be such a big character, obviously the Aes Sedai are a big faction. It's just, you know, that play back and play through is obviously going to be important in the future.
And there's no way that this is it between them, right? Like, I know we've seen a lot of scenes from the trailer between them already, but like, this is blue balls. If this is all we're getting, we got to be getting more. I know Rand seemed to say, you can't teach me shit, and like walks out. Kind of makes sense, because Loghain was being a little bit of an asshole, but this just felt like not enough. And are we on the same page that we're getting more, or is there a chance that this is, that's all we need at Loghain for?
what I was getting was that at the very end, when he does set the house ablaze in his sleep, I guess he was just channeling in his sleep, that he realized he needs to just listen to this madman and go back and listen to what he has to say, because if he keeps going like this, he's not going to be able to figure it out. He's going to kill somebody eventually.
That sounds perfect. That sounds like perfect writing. We're doing that. Yep.
I mean, I'm with you, Luke, though. It's blue balls if we don't get more, because I've been definitely loving every second of their interactions.
And I know dreams are like a huge part in this series. Like, I know it's not, dreams mean something, so it's hard to tell if a dream is literally just a dream that caused him to react and literally just set his house ablaze, or if somebody was doing it, like affecting him in his sleep, so he did it on purpose. Like, it's just hard because it's a crazy world, and I love it, honestly. It's
so
crazy.
Let's talk through the final scene, and maybe some of these questions will kind of get answered, because I actually have a question myself about, like, was this was all a dream, right? The initial first part when Rand starts getting banging hot and heavy with her. Okay, cool. Because I was, for a second, thought
that was
happening. I don't think so.
In my opinion, that was real.
I thought it was real too, but then they like bang, and all of a sudden he just wakes up in his bed alone
without
like
the coat on.
Seemed like a rough editing cut.
Her,
in my opinion, that seemed like a rough editing cut.
Where
I took it as a dream. I just, because he wakes up and he's still doing the fire shit that he like awoke from the dream that like caused him to wake up, and that's how I took it.
It started taking him.
She is clearly like outside coming from somewhere.
Okay.
Unless she like left, like they had sex, she left in the middle of the night.
That was
and then,
my
like,
take.
Came back. Yeah.
Okay. So, but didn't she clarify earlier on the season, this all the nights end the same, like him leaving her versus like, I don't know. I'm on
yeah,
team.
But,
dream.
I mean, they banged last episode for the first time.
Yeah. And I think it was, she was coming back for more. She was a little crazy. But then at the same time, like the one power is like taking him over while they're hooking up, and it almost like seems like that's when he's like really losing control.
Well, she was saying like show me it, and I thought she was like trying to say like show me your power, which felt like a dream thing to say almost.
It almost did, so it did seem like, I don't know if she was like, she's actually a dark friend, she was trying to trigger it.
Either way, we're all in agreement that it was because he was getting hot and heavy, like Luke said, in his dream, that caused him to start feeling the fire weaves or whatever, and then that's what caused the house to.
Another wrinkle
I'm on team. It was real.
Okay, well, we're gonna I don't even know how we could find out if it was real or not, but another wrinkle to it is, like you're saying, she says show me, but even if he channels in front of her, women and male and men,
that's what I'm saying,
each other's weaves regardless.
That's what I'm saying.
I took it as like she was like, show me, like she says like let go. Like, I thought it was like she could tell, like, and like, again, like we've talked about, like Rand has these kind of two sides to him. Like, she tells him to like keep the lordly clothing on and like all that stuff. I feel like she was like into like the idea of like him a dressed like that and acting like that. I thought that's what I took out of it. Cause I mean, she like kind of, because last episode, she was definitely into him, kind of manhandling her a little bit. She kind of does it this time. And then I just feel like she's into, in my opinion, that like level of physicality.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with that scene. He let go a little bit, and that's what caused him to, because he let go a little bit later that night when he was asleep. It triggered because he wasn't like on guard.
I think it's also difficult because while we're in the White Tower and we're watching them channel Sidar, the women half, like we're seeing the colors. Kind of, you know, here. And I feel like Rands have always been like a golden orangey color, you know, so it's kind of, is he just doing nothing but channeling fire? I guess that's a take, but I don't know. I think it's that, I think, is a little potentially confusing as well, because like he actually channeling fire when he's like on top or on the bed, or like that was just the color of it at the moment, because he's obviously channeling fire when he wakes up and it's like that color. So I don't know.
I mean, the good thing is that we thought we were never going to get an answer in season one about if Loghain was actually laughing crazily or if it was in Matt's head or whatever, and we somehow did. So maybe there's a way we'll get an answer about what's going on here. I'm sure the more we see Rand scenes, especially probably the next episode, we'll have a little bit of a better idea of like the level of losing control he's having, and if Celine has any, you know, more Celine scenes are going to be great too. So I think this conversation will come back up.
Was I crazy? And maybe I was just like forcing myself to see it, but was there some black streaks going in the wheat, like in his channeling? Was that just me? I feel like I was seeing a little bit of black, just kind of to emphasize that he was going mad a little bit. But I was probably like making myself try to see that, you know?
I agree that it feels like they've somewhat shied away from how like obvious it was when Loghain was channeling last season.
And I would hope it's because Loghain was more corrupted or like and, yeah, I was gonna the power more.
That was going to be my question is, I guess that hasn't been explained yet. Quite yet is like, is the black supposed to signify how corrupt you are, or is it just like a signature of Loghain's, you know? That's something I'll just throw out into the void.
Yeah,
we'll see. And then you know, little detail that was important that we care about is that Rand still has the sword. He saved the sword from the fire, so he still has Tam's sword. It's literally his only possession in the world.
Yeah,
so.
He grabbed that in his coat. I just like going back. I know what you guys said was supposed to happen at like the end of book one. Like Rand was supposed to like come back and like blow up everything in the battlefield and kill all the Trollocs and be a badass. Mm-hmm. And I totally see how his character is not even touching how cool he might be in the books right now, because all he did right now was unleash Ishmael. Like, he didn't really do anything and save anybody. All he did was do that and hide away. So it's kind of like waiting for him to do something. I know he's trying to figure it out, but it's I can see how book readers are like, yo, like poking him with a stick, like do something.
Yeah. It is fairly book accurate up until this point in the book too. So like obviously book readers, like you said, we got, you know, the moment, the sick moment. Part of that, just to be, I guess, long-winded, is that like the Eye of the World is supposed to be like a pure, untainted pool of the One Power. So it's just like, you know, a Sa'angreal on fucking steroids, and that he can literally like light up the sky and like feel the earth and the air and everything type of deal. But also, I mean, book two, he is so afraid of himself after that, that he is actively trying not to channel, just like he is now in the show. He channels in his sleep in the books, just like it seems like he's done in this episode. So it is kind of taking that lockstep. Obviously, it looks differently, but the idea of it is still kind of there. So, I mean, I think also book readers, we were kind of just like, okay, when's the next time he's going to fucking crack that melon open and just be a fucking savage again? So,
yeah, because I mean, he has no idea of extent of his powers, I guess. All he did was really kind of break the, I mean, well, that was pretty fucking cool, but break the Heartstone. But like, if what's he afraid of himself for? He didn't do anything crazy. He didn't do any damage like out to anybody. The biggest thing he did was, you know, kill that guy in the alleyway, I guess. But
and I don't think it's about like him thinking he's going to do something crazy with the power, but it's more about the madness that he's avoiding practicing or even using it. Like there's no situation where he's going to be like sitting at a table and like practicing his weaves, because every time he touches it, he gets like the madness starts going into you. So that's the reason why Loghain is so important here, because he's the only one that's going to be able to help him without him getting closer and closer to madness. But yeah, like I'll leave it at that, just because I don't want to say
anything. They conveniently have that little private garden, so
yeah,
I guess we'll see where that goes. That might be a take to put on the board. And yeah, also he's afraid of the fact that if someone knows he channels, they're going to kill him. Like he'll be a social pariah, so he doesn't like absolutely does not want to use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So,
get the Perrin and crew, right?
Yeah. So moving into the happy fairy tale storyline. So we left off last episode where we see the big palanquin with this mysterious woman with the easily identifiable long fingernails that we met at the beginning of episode one in the Dark Friend Social. And yeah, we're at Atuan's Mill. So that was another one where I was like, holy shit, I would die for subtitles right now. But I went to like towns in Wheel of Time and scrolled through fucking however many they are, fucking 150, and found the one.
Awesome.
So Atuan's Mill is a place in this. So they didn't make this up, which is nice, because at first I was like, they fucking made this place up. But essentially what we're going on here is that these invaders, we learned that they are named the Seanchan.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of just organizing all the townsfolk, and they're pretty much making them all swear oaths. So, I mean, in my opinion, we can just kind of rip all of this that's kind of going on in the day before we get to like the caravan stuff. So everything that's with the swearing of the oaths, all that kind of, a lot does happen. I have a ton of notes for this, but just kind of takes on everything.
Ever since you said that the pacifiers were supposed to be necklaces or like neck braces, or like collars. I just wish it was that so badly because I'm like, she like flicks her fingernail and like, oh, here comes the pacifier babies. And
yeah, like, here's the babies. I literally have in my notes, like one of the babies begins searching through the crowd. Yeah.
Especially because it was like a younger woman too. And it's like, oh, here's it comes a toddler. Like still has a pacifier. So, I mean, it was menacing that they were just like picking girls. I don't know if that meant anything, like girls with potential to touch the one power or just like girls for other dark Epstein Island type thing. Gross. But
jeez,
I don't know. I don't know what it possibly was, but it couldn't have been a good thing. And oh my God, Uno. Rip.
Boo, dude. Fuck that, man.
That was so gross.
Does that not happen?
No, Uno is a book 14, homie.
Oh my God. I'd be furious.
Dude, that I don't know. That's why I don't know who made that decision.
My jaw dropped when it happened because I was like, that is intense and a terrible way to die. But I was like, Uno's a fan favorite. Like, there's no way that, like, I could easily see him living past this in the book. So I would be furious if I was you guys.
I'll just say it's not the end of the world, but my initial note was, are we back into this as a B tier show? Because it happened so early in this episode. I was pissed. But it was like if you didn't have any book knowledge, like that was a good like Game of Thrones kill moment, which
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was like, my jaw was literally open. I know we say that all the time, but I was like looking around, like, where's Kyle to look at Kyle so he knows that I know that we know. What the fuck, dude? I was freaking out. That's how I felt.
I feel like this was a death we needed. Yeah. I feel like it's been a minute since we've had any, you know, tensity and anything like life threatening. So it's good to see that, you know, characters can just eat the bullet whenever they want.
Sad though, he's great, man. He curses so much and every other word. Yeah. He's just great.
I love his complaining.
Was also very unique, I feel like, too. Like, it was a different take on a curb stomping that I had never seen
also,
before.
Yeah, yeah. A little like it shows the kind of the brutality of the Shonshin. I mean, they literally have that thing there for that reason.
Yeah, it was literally like at the bottom of the steps.
Yeah, it's there for that exact reason. My take is that I think that on one hand, like, this does a really good job of A, like I said, doing that Shonshin brutality. B, this I feel like very clearly spells out for us that actions have consequences. You know what I mean? Like, Uno couldn't keep his mouth shut. Even when it was kind of low stakes of them, like, he's talking shit about Elias kind of right behind him, all that kind of stuff. He's clearly like, Massima's trying to get him to be like, fucking put the knife away, like, chill out, all that kind of stuff. And I think it does a good job of showing us that, you know, like in that Game of Thrones line of thinking of, you know, actions have consequences. Like, if you slip up and step to the wrong person, like, you might fucking get got like this. I would agree, Lou, the first time I saw it, I was like, no fucking way. Like, I'm pissed. But the more I really think about it, Uno plays like two, maybe like one and a half potentially like big roles throughout the rest of this series. You know, one of them may have come, I mean, like, granted, yeah, throughout the season he'd play a role. Maybe in like season four or five-ish he would play like a fairly decent role, but technically there's like two, like, he's with another person, so like that person could just take that storyline, and that's a character we'll get introduced to that is a bigger character than Uno is. So like, I'm sure he'll just eat Uno's storyline or the rest of that storyline himself. And the last part when he comes back, it's just like a feel good, like, oh my God, Uno's back type of deal. So it's like, I can see why he kind of made a list of expendable, and especially of like this will get everyone who's watching fucking like, oh my God.
So yeah, that, like, was my thought on it, is that like this, they got to, I feel like they want to keep it a little bit fresh too, also for the book readers. And while it sounds like Uno was a fan favorite, something like this does make you kind of view the show a little bit differently, in the sense that, like, okay, maybe I don't know everything that's coming, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, and I'll things I wrote, and I'm so sorry to step over you, but it just, like, I can see how the conversations led to him being expendable, and he's probably the most expendable of the Shinarans that we know. So that's kind of writings on the wall.
I'll drop a couple of lore things here that I've written down, then you can clean up whatever I miss, because there was some good stuff here that I'm pretty happy that they already included it. But one of the things that not the Empress, but like her speaker, because she doesn't talk to anybody, right? Like, you kind of already figured that out from last episode. She never speaks to the public. One of the things that she says is that this is the declaration of what they call the return, coming back to this country. I'm not going to get too specific because I don't know how much they're going to naturally and organically give to us over these next couple episodes. But she does say, like, we left with, and I think they say Luther Pendragon.
Yeah, Luther Pendrag's fleet.
Luther Pendrag's fleet. And then they're coming back to reclaim their lands. And then they tell everybody that they need to swear the oath. And one of the coolest things about the Sean Chan, and I won't talk too much about it, is just the oath is really cool because you could tell, like, they'll kill Uno if you don't say the oath. But if you say the oath, you're pretty much fine. Like, you're in the, you're absorbed. So we're going to get to explore that dynamic a little bit more, but it is cool that they can be bloodthirsty, but they can be reasonable if you succumb, like, to their demands. And I just wish Uno bent the knee, bro. Come on.
Yeah. Tough. Interesting. Luther Pendrag is like a really famous character. Like, Luke, we're keeping it, like, we'll learn more. Essentially, he's just like their version of like Alexander the Great plus like Genghis Khan plus like King Arthur. Like,
what's his,
like,
name? Uther.
Luther Pendrag.
It was funny because I think Luke said Uther Pendragon, which I'm pretty sure is Arthur, King yeah. Arthur's dad.
Oh, that's like 100%.
Yeah. It's where the inspiration. On, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's like,
because when you said Alexander the Great, I was thinking the same. Like, I was like, it's got to be kind of related to that.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And just a very small correction, because this will become a thing, is that the woman with the long fingernails, her name is High Lady Suroth. So she's Suroth. Not. Suroth. Yeah, oh. Suroth. Yeah.
Sorry.
So she's yeah, not the right. Emperor. That's okay. She's not the Emperor. She's quite close. And she obviously is wielding a high level of power, but she's just kind of like a really, really high ranking noble woman.
They're awesome. I really like the Swan Chan. Is that what they were called?
Sean.
Sean, like the name. Sean, like the name Sean.
Swan Chan.
Swan Chan.
The Swan Chan.
That's Swan what she John. Should name herself if she gets absorbed into the empire.
I literally have it written down as the name Sean and then Chan. And that's yeah, how I'm going to remember
yep,
it.
The baby.
It's one word, but yeah.
Yeah, it was one word. Yeah,
that's literally it. It's basically if Jackie Chan had a son and named him Sean.
That's literally how I'm pronouncing it. Yep, Sean Chan.
Yeah, Sean Chan. Yeah. Yep. Honestly, now that I said that, it reminds me of Jeff Chang from
Jeff Chang. Yeah, yep.
Great movie. All right. Yeah, I don't know how much I have to add, like, lore wise. I just thought it was funny that, like, she kept using one hand to signal them around. But, like, I like how Uno gets all four fingernails. She lifts all four up.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was like execution. Her version of the Joaquin Phoenix. So that's funny. That would be hilarious if that's consistent throughout the whole thing. I would love that.
I hope so. Four yeah. up, four down. You're dead.
And then just again, I feel like they're doing a good job of building out Inktar's character when he's like begging Perrin, when he pretty much says to Perrin, like, our pride's not worth more than our life.
Yeah. I disagree. Vegeta would disagree as well.
So okay, you would
put that pride on the fucking line, baby. Let's go.
I mean, they just showed what happened when you put that pride on the line, and you're not a fucking intergalactic Saiyan.
It would spike your head through Uno's head. They would leave Uno's head there.
All I was thinking is Vegeta would never. Vegeta would never.
And just only other thing I want to point out is just that obviously Ishii's like, I fucking Perrin. We'll get to the next scene for more about that. But that was like, oh god, okay.
People love to eye fuck Perrin.
That's a great point.
The end of this scene, Perrin didn't get like hit on the head, did he? Like, they just kind of ended the scene and he just wakes up in the carriage.
That was my impression, yes.
Okay, because I don't know if I missed something, because he seemed like he had like a new wound with like the blood on his head. I don't know. And he just kind of woke up there without realizing. So I didn't know what happened, but
yeah, I could feel like, you know, a little off screen manhandling to get him in there. Last little comment, just to obviously we're going to give the writers some shit if we don't like what they do, give them some, you know, praise when I do like what they do. So I mentioned at the top of this that Atuan's mill is a location in the books. It's actually a location that our party goes to in the books. So in the books, we arrive pretty much after a scene like this, and our characters are asking all the survivors that are left, are like, what happened type of deal. So I thought that's like a kind of genius shift to like actually place us there to give us this introduction to the Sean Chan. So,
and what region is it in?
It's in Almuth Plain, which means nothing to these guys, but I'm still holding on hope that we'll get more of a discussion of geography and maps and such. And if not, we'll take matters into our own hands and we'll show you guys a damn map.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now we get the caravan scene. So we kind of, the first half of the scene is going to be just like a really informative and interesting conversation between Shamiel and Perrin. And then the second half of the scene is going to be just like a really nice, quick battle kind of rescue scene. So I would say let's talk about all the Shamiel stuff before we get into Elias. That would be, I guess, maybe the only potential guardrails on a conversation.
Crazy. Just, I didn't know this was going to be two people that were going to be face-to-face having a convo. Like, this is such another wild pairing that I wasn't ready for. So I loved it. You know, Perrin's an interesting guy. People can tell right away that he's got something inside of him. And he even says at the one point, like, the more wolf you are, the more you're mine, which is just, like, awesome.
Just like, I just don't know what that
claiming
means.
Claiming the power is like a dark power is kind of what I took from that. But, dude, the Eyes of Ember, whew, that was sick. Just to show that flash again.
They literally answered your guys' question perfectly.
Yeah,
definitely.
Because, when we talked about that last episode. And, I think, again, just to bring up the Dark Friend Social, when he's talking with the Trolloc, I think that's part of it as well. When he's like, it's so hard to be both. And he's kind of now taunting Perrin almost of like, if you lose out this battle, like, you're pretty much mine.
Mm-hmm.
So just adding, I mean, obviously Perrin's worried about what the hell's going on with him, but, then next thing you know, what you think's the Dark One is adding on just another layer of pressure on top of it. I'm sure he's sweating bullets now.
It's just so confusing because, again, I keep bringing it back like to how Perrin got this injury is like Trolloc related in my head, even though we kind of know it's not. But then, now we have Ishmael talking about how the more he uses it, the more he becomes mine. So I'm still making these connections, even though I know I shouldn't be. And now I'm also thinking, like, I feel like this scene kind of confirms for me, at least, maybe not 100%, but I feel like I'm getting confirmation now that Elias does have this same power. And why is it different for Elias to be able to use his power so constantly and not be Ishmael's like lapdog? Whereas for Perrin, it is that way. Again, probably just shouting questions into the void here, but just something that I'm thinking about currently.
Yeah. And I don't know if he means like the more you give into it, like the more you give into your anger because he's like the father of lies. I don't know if he means like the wolf specifically or just like how you get to the powers. That's what he's talking about, like through that anger. So I don't know, but be able to call fucking wolves is just such a cool thing that I didn't know I wanted to do. Like,
I just loved all the how much we get howling in the show. It's just
dude. So when I heard the howling,
savages,
I just started winding it up because I was like, Elias.
Yeah, he just comes swinging in, kicks the door down. I mean, just more characterization of Shamiel. The first part is that he says, like, I pretty much saved you from the spike. So he's, telling us there that he holds a level of clout with High Lady Surath, who we've seen on her own demonstrate an insane level of clout. So I mean, we kind of knew that, but it's just nice to keep getting that reinforcement. And then I love the line, I want to meet the monster. And then the last thing will be, I love how there's chaos erupting outside and he just like calmly kind of like walks out of the caravan.
It felt unfazed. Like he knew this was going to happen. That's just how I took it almost.
I mean, so he was calm. Unbothered. He didn't really care.
Yeah, like the way he was delivering all this, like his words and just how he was talking to Perrin, everything just timed up perfectly when the invasion happened. He knew this was going to happen. I feel like he knew Perrin wasn't going to make it all the way.
Again, the quote unquote like antagonist characters, Leandra and I think toast the line, but like they have just been fantastic, which is such a thing that the show needs. So it's just so good that the quote unquote kind of bad people, antagonists, whatever, because again, Landrin isn't really an antagonist, I guess you could say, but they're just fucking fantastic, which is great.
Well, I am on Team Dark One, baby.
Sure you are on Dave. Dave would immediately turn to the dark.
I don't want to say confirmed because, like I said in season one, we don't use that word around here. Yeah. Way too early.
Dave just did. But.
But like, I almost feel like half the time Ishmael isn't actually there because he did do that, like visions and shit when he was in the prison. So like, I don't even know if he's actually in there with Perrin. So when he walks out, it's all just a show and he's actually somewhere else. I mean, he's calm, cool, collected. It's fucking cool. I mean, I don't know how strong the Forsaken are if they can just like travel and teleport like that. And I don't know, but they were cool. But Kyle, question for you. What were the names of all the wolves that attacked? Because I assume Elias named all the wolves.
You know what's funny is that it's probably answerable. I'm just kidding.
I mean, at some level it might be. But do you want their wolf names or the human interpretation of their wolf names?
Both. Like, okay. It's like the Latin scientific name and the common
okay.
name.
Yeah. You know, we've been here for a little while talking about the episode, so me and you can talk about that offline. We don't want to bore the listeners with all that lore knowledge.
He
How about that?
let me throw a final take or two out here just to end the episode for myself. I actually loved the forced, like, the what are we calling them? The baby benders?
Yeah,
that already sounds amazing to my ears.
Baby benders.
Baby benders. That name sings in my ear.
I love it.
So I like how they show them channeling. Like, it was more mechanical, and like you could tell, like, it was just like the way they were doing it is different than any Aes Sedai. Like, Moraine's more like graceful. Like, the way they do it is different, and that's just a really cool subtle thing because they're from a whole different part of the world. So even if they have access to the powers, they would be using them differently like this. So I really like that subtle little touch of, you can tell when it's a Sean Chen channeling versus an Aes Sedai just based on the hands. Like, if you just saw that part of it, and it was really cool. Cause it was just like, it looked like Naruto, like,
it
looked
very, like harsh, like the motions kinda. Were like harsh. Whereas like the Aes Sedai kind of flow a little bit.
Yeah.
More,
right. It didn't
like,
it kind of
like, yeah, it was like, jutsus, it was like this. Yeah, absolutely.
I'll let you guys talk about that if you want anything else there. But the other piece was, I love that moment of Elias saying like, get out of here, he has blood on him, and he just full sprints at two of the guards that are, and just with no weapons in his hand or anything. So that was awesome. We're gonna fucking, Elias is just so cool.
It definitely makes me think that he can turn into a wolf because of all the blood that was on his mouth. Like, he turned into a wolf and bit. There's a big chance he just bit somebody with like his human form and his human teeth because he's a wolf. But I mean, that's the first thing I thought was, all right, this guy's basically like an animorph, like right into wolves.
I mean, that was your original prediction, wasn't it? Or
I feel like Paul personally definitely said in season one that like we're leaning like werewolf-ish territory. Yeah.
You were a werewolf guy.
Yeah, but I was saying wolf traits,
I believe, on the re-listen, yeah. I think.
And like, then you said wolf king, and I guess technically that could, maybe you could infer from that he would turn into a wolf.
Yeah.
You didn't actually say that, so.
I'm in. All right.
You're letting me build out your theory for you.
Yeah, I say things and I forget them, and then you say them, and I'm like, that's a great idea. Oh, you said that. And I'm like, oh, shit, okay.
Paul, I want to ask you, though, do you think Elias's and Paradin's abilities are one and the same, or do you think...
Yeah, I want to say yeah. And he just needs to learn, and this is going to be his mentor, opportunity. Just like Logan's going to be Rand's mentor.
Logan. It's so hard, and I can't tell if like you're making a joke or not. So.
Yeah, I'm always joking. My
gut reaction is to kind of be thinking the writers are doing it wrong. My gut reaction will just be, you're joking and making a good joke.
Yeah, totally. Okay. That's good. Real quick, can I go first for MVP, LVP? Because I haven't gone to go first yet. And my MVP, Elias. There we go. He's cool.
He claims him.
Yeah. He's got an award every episode.
He's just so cool, especially here. Like, he comes in, worked on his social skills a little bit. We were talking last episode. He needs to learn how to do sentences and talk with a human. Did a better job this time, let alone saving him and just being a beast, like you said, just jumping at people with no weapons. Just don't worry, I got him. Follow my buddy Wolf Wolf over there. Like, he'll take you home. Like, that's, it's just so cool. So I do know
that wolf's name, but I won't spoil it.
I think he said it. But I was like, I don't have fucking subtitles.
He says, go follow, and then names the wolf. But yeah. There's no subtitles.
Well, just wait for that next episode.
Is it Wolf Wolf?
That'd be wild if you just nailed it on your first.
Guessed it. And my LVP, fucking Uno, man. Just bend the knee.
Damn, bro. Are you going to fucking spit on his grave?
Wow. He spit on the palanquin and then fucking caused him. All he needs to do is kneel.
You took offense to him fucking not taking the oath.
We might have to fight Paul after you hear my
What good
MVP.
Is dying right there?
All right, let's hear it then, Dave.
MVP is going to Uno, baby.
Oh, my God.
Pride. Pride before the lies, baby. Love it. No, I just thought he went out in a badass way. spit in the fucking queen's face. Love to see it. I mean, I wouldn't personally have the. Not the queen.
You're good. I just want to, you know, reinforce that.
I'm gonna call her long fingernail princess, but
don't spit in her.
Spit in her face. Let her know I'm not bending any knee, and I'm gonna honor him with an MVP rather than dishing out an LVP for him. And then the LVP I will give to easy one for me, Matt. I don't think there's really much else to say beyond that.
I went last episode, so I'm going to go next. Mm-hmm. My MVP was going to be Elias, but I'm going to just take Leandrin as my pick. Kate Fleetwood is putting on such a good performance. I don't even like, you know, it's obvious. You don't love her character, but you love her performance. And just every time she's on the screen, she's great. So the more we get of her, the better the show is going to be. LVP was going to be Matt, just because he's a coward with that Egwene scene. So I'll just say my next pick, which I didn't have any other good options. So this is like a fake LVP, but I'm going to pick Min.
Damn it.
Yeah. I'm just going to pick Min for playing games with Matt, even though Matt deserved to be the LVP this episode.
So true.
We're going to see how that plays out, but keep that in the back of your mind anytime we're seeing Min scenes.
Is that an LVP storyline?
Damn. Okay. So my MVP is going to be Elaine Trakahn, the daughter heir of Andor, just because she has shown herself. I feel like she's really Ferta. She's just a rider. Egwene seems like her first friend ever, you know, and she's pretty good at this thing she hasn't done before. After a couple days, you know, she's being a pretty good friend. And I'm a big Elaine guy. And then my LVP will be the baby benders.
Yes.
Get that thang out your mouth and stop fucking, I don't know, obeying.
Wouldn't
it? I like their concept art, by the way, or like their design, just for the record. I know
I'm a little
bit.
It
just looks like a mouthpiece or a pacifier, like Paul said. It just throws me off.
Yeah. I just saw this like at the end of this episode. I'm like, this is the best episode yet. But like, I think that after everyone, I forgot how good like the mystery of just discovering this world and how satisfying it is. I love the show. I'm so excited for the next episode. I'm looking forward to a few different things. Min and Matt, I'm really excited to get them out and about. I really want some more Matt. But also what Leandrin said, like Moraine won't have anything over either of us again if you succeed in this. Like, I don't think we know what that is. I think Moraine said last episode about the man that she visits. I don't know if that's what she's talking about. But also, like, Min, how does Min come into that? So, looking forward to a lot of storylines. I think that I said that last episode. Like, anybody who comes up on the screen, I'm just, like, very excited now. And last time, it was like, I don't really care less. Now I'm like, let's go.
Yeah, Gwaine and Perrin, I feel like, were rough for us a little bit in season one. I remember that. The two certainly. Of you guys saying that. Yeah,
certainly.
I want a little bit of a pause in the White Tower. Not that I'm not loving everything there, but let's progress some of the other ones. Get the highlight. It feels like the White Tower is taking up like 50-60% of all these episodes, which makes sense. There's a lot of characters there, but give me some more Rand. Give me some Moraine. Let's get to the Sean Chen. Like, this is, I want to, let's progress them for an episode, and then we can meet back up in the mid season, you know?
Yeah, very interesting. We got no Moraine and Lan this episode.
Well, we got fake Lan.
True.
I'm sexy lying. Hair.
Sexy
yeah,
land.
Saying, yeah, that's true. Land. That's true. We got erotica land. I forgot about that. I wasn't even thinking of him as the same person. Yeah. Dave, any parting shots?
Nothing for me. Just give me the new false dragon reborn into my veins. That's what I'm just literally dying for every episode.
You're patiently waiting for a Mazrim Tame.
Yes, that's who it is.
And the final question, Dave, who you drafted in the first round?
We are going to go with, hopefully, Saquon Barkley with the 9th overall pick. We have keepers, too. Just let people out there know. So I'm not just, I don't want to seem like an idiot. We got keepers, but I'm taking Saquon, I think, at the 9th.
The caveat. I just think that last episode was better. This was still a very good episode. I'm still feeling pretty good about where kind of the changes that they're making. We didn't like go into a ton of detail about all the changes they made. Like, that in itself kind of shows that like I'm okay with, you know, pretty much all of them. We'll see how things progress. Season one was, I was feeling really good after the first three episodes. I think we were all fucking gassed up after the first three episodes. So I guess we'll, you know, we're holding on, taking it an episode at a time, but this was just great. I mean, it's just fun. And I just love to hear that you guys are liking every storyline, because that's the way I was in the books for pretty much almost like the whole run. It was just nice to, you know, get all the different characters and everything. And I think everything right now is kind of cooking at the moment, which is nice. All right, that's going to do it for season two, episode three, What Might Be. Wheel of Time. What definitely will be is that we'll be back for episode four, whatever that's called, because I don't know off the top of my head. Yeah, Paul, you like that? That was for you. Stick around, obviously. You know, we'll be doing these weekly at this point. They just dropped all three of them at once. Then we'll move to weekly, thank God. So our social lives and everything we do outside of podcasting and work can have a little bit of chance to flourish like fantasy football. We're also covering One Piece and Jujutsu Kaisen at this point. So we're just busy, busy guys, obviously. I just, like I said at the top, best way to support us is always just going to be subscribing whenever you're watching or listening on. And just, you know, literally listening to the episodes, I think, is the best way to support us. And then if you want to interact with us, it's always going to be Twitter. Or X, as Dave likes to call it, at Bingetown TV. Dave's a big X fan. And then Discord, the link will be in the description of this
episode.
You're
missing two X's there.
Yeah, well, we all know about that one. You know what I was laughing about? We had like a random talk in season one about like our insecurities or something, or like what it would be. And like you were just like, yeah, I mean, clearly it would be my inadequate penis size.
I can't believe we have that on podcast. We have too many people listening. We got to pull the plug on this podcast, man. Too many people are listening.
I just re-listened to it and I was like, I love that. And then Paul was like, yeah, I mean, like, I don't really use mine that well. And it was just like, it just completely devolved into that conversation. And it was like maybe 4 minutes and we were like, okay, I don't even remember what scene we were talking about.
Townies, you got about another like half year out of us before we're pulling the plug.
Yeah. Well, now it's going to be on the other one's on the internet too. I mean, on YouTube. So, yeah, that's literally all I got. Love you guys. Thanks for listening.
Peace.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.